Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Court of Sugar and Spice, a Nutcracker Retelling, by Rebecca F. Kenny, narrated by Jessica Jeffries. 1. Clara. The house rears up, mountainous and morose, craggy with dormer windows and crooked little slanted roofs and odd bits of towers, like pointed noses. It seems to peer down unhappily at Louisa and me, despite the fact that both of us have dressed impeccably for our arrival. "I still say we don't need a guardian," mutters Louisa. "Of course we don't. We're both over 20, but we have no money, no place to go, and no useful skills." "Your paintings?" "Painting is not a useful skill." I taste the bitterness of Papa's frequent reminder on my tongue. "Art does not pay. Not in this district. And due to the unreasonable conditions of Papa's will, I won't be able to afford to leave this district for another few years. Louisa and I have been barred from accessing our inheritance until we turn 30, or until we marry, whichever comes first. In the meantime, we are to live with a man Papa appointed as our guardian many years ago, our godfather, Uncle Drosselmeyer." "Must we call him our uncle, though?" asks Louisa. "He isn't, not really. Just an old friend of Papa's." "I suppose we'll call him whatever he wants to be called," I reply vaguely, occupied with counting our bags and trunks. The carriage driver doesn't wait for me to ascertain that we have everything. He merely chucks the reins and urges the horses ahead, as if he's eager to be gone from this place before nightfall. Fortunately, all our luggage is accounted for. "Come on, then. Might as well get it over with." Louisa hoists two bags over her shoulder and picks up a suitcase. Other visitors to this house might have waited for the servants to help with the luggage, but Louisa and I are used to doing everything ourselves. Papa didn't trust servants, nor did he care to spend money on paying them when he had two perfectly good daughters to handle the chores. "If only we could earn the money to move to Engelborg, just the two of us. We could hire ourselves out to cook or clean." I pick up a carpet bag and drag our trunk by one handle. "Or mend. I can mend clothes." "I doubt our guardian will take kindly to his ward's scrubbing privies and floors," Louisa wrinkles her nose. "As for me, I plan to marry quickly so I can get my money." "I'm not sure how many prospects you'll find here." With a grating lunge, I haul the trunk up the last stone step and pause, turning to survey the countryside around us. A bleak expanse of brown fields, leafless grey trees, dark, distant moors, and black hills in the far distance, beneath a soggy, grey sky. "It's rutting unfair, that's what it is," moans Louisa, turning her back to the front door and following my gaze. "Not a house to be seen, not even a barn with a strapping stable boy, or a flock of sheep with a virile young shepherd. Would you listen to yourself? You can't speak like that here. Uncle Drosselmeyer sounds like a very proper older gentleman. He must be if he was Papa's dear friend." "You're right. I can't imagine Papa having a rake of a friend with loose morals." Louisa pushes out her lower lip. "That would have been so interesting, though. I could have seduced him and..."
"Seduced me?" says a low voice behind us. "Gracious, how shocking."
I whirl, my stomach plummeting. While we were gazing at the countryside, one of the large double doors behind us opened without so much as a squeak, and in the aperture stands a lean man in a dark suit. The suit isn't any style I've previously seen. It has multiple stand-up collars, their corners bent at random angles, and his entire tailcoat is slashed with pockets and rows of buttons in odd places. The cuffs splay wide, framing thin fingers laced with delicate brass rings, some featuring tiny gears or minuscule gems. Uncle Drosselmeyer's face is narrow, with sharp triangular features and thin, compressed lips. He wears thick, brass-rimmed spectacles and sports a neat brown beard. It's difficult to tell his age. "I'm so sorry," I gasp. "Don't mind Louisa. She... I'm quite out of my mind," my sister says cheerfully, thrusting out her hand. "I often say the first thing that pops into my head. You must learn not to pay me any attention." Drosselmeyer steps forward onto the snowy doorstep, taking the other handle of the trunk I'm dragging.
"I make it a habit to always pay attention when a woman speaks to me. It's the ones who are out of their minds who have the most fascinating and insightful things to say."
"I like you,"
Louisa waggles a finger at him, smiling. Yes, I think we'll get along just fine. She hustles inside with her share of the baggage, and Drosselmeyer helps me with mine. Thank you for opening your home to us, I say. I know it must be difficult, making space for two strangers.
We may never have met in person, but I feel as if I know you both, he says. Your father wrote letters about you from the time you were very young. You might be surprised how many stories I know from your childhood.
Oh, I can't decide if this revelation makes me feel more secure or uncomfortable. I'm sure Papa had plenty to say of me. Louisa is darting from side to side of the entry hall, inspecting the giant portraits of moody ancestors. Clara never does anything remotely rebellious, and everyone knows it's the rebels who make the best stories.
He had plenty to say about both of you, Drosselmeyer replies. Put your luggage on this platform here, and step back, if you please.
Once the luggage is piled onto the metal square he indicated, he opens a panel in the wall and flips a lever. With a clank and a whir, the platform lurches into motion, lifts and begins to glide up the staircase, following the line of the banister up to the second floor.
Marvellous! Louisa claps. Papa said you were a great innovator.
Did he?
Yes, I put in. We would love to see your workshop.
No one enters my workshop, says Drosselmeyer curtly. Then in a gentler tone he adds, though I could show you my exhibition room. It's where I display my inventions once they are completed. In fact, I'm hosting a dinner party tomorrow night, and many of the district's most esteemed families will be represented.
You don't say! Louisa shoots me an excited glance. May we attend this fine dinner?
Louisa, I hiss reproachfully. But Drosselmeyer smiles.
Of course. You are part of the household now.
Glorious! Louisa claps her hands. I know just what to wear.
She dances up the carpeted staircase, following the platform that carries our luggage. I follow more sedately, just behind our godfather.
Do people buy the things you make? I ask.
Sometimes. Certain things I prefer to keep for myself.
I understand that. There are some paintings I've done that I could never bear to part with.
Yes, your father told me you were an artist. Didn't seem too pleased about it. Fritz could never see the value in beauty for beauty's sake. Always thought a thing must have a purpose. But what is life without a little gratuitous beauty?
Exactly. Eagerness surges in my heart. Maybe here I'll have someone to speak with about art styles and different media, about perspective and colour theory.
Louisa's room and mine are on the second floor, connected by a beautiful lavatory complete with a shining copper tub. The wood panelling is dark, and so is the furniture, but there are lovely porcelain vases on the heavy dressers and side tables, and each vase is filled with winter grass, red bud branches, and fluffy white snow bloom. Drosselmeyer helps us transfer the luggage from the stairlift to the rooms. Before he leaves us to unpack, he says,
Dinner will be in the first floor dining room at 7 o'clock. You may go anywhere you like in the house, but the third floor is reserved for my workshop, my study, and my suite. Please respect my privacy.
Louisa is sitting on my bed, and after the door closes behind him, she says,
When he puts it like that, it feels wrong to think about exploring the third floor. Why couldn't he have simply glowered and declared it forbidden? Then I would have no compunction about going up there. Now, if I do, I'll have guilt, because he framed it as a respectful request.
She sighs, plucking at the corner of a crocheted blanket.
Face it, Lou, he's neither a rake you can charm nor a monster you can hate.
I throw her a satisfied smirk.
How very sad for you.
It is. But that dinner tomorrow night, that has promise. Provided the guests are not all stuffy old gentlemen and their wrinkled ladies. Age doesn't make someone uninteresting. I would argue the opposite.
But it does make them unmarriageable. Louisa slides off my bed. I'm off to hang up my dresses and see which ones need pressing. I suppose I'll have to press them myself, as usual. I haven't seen any servants. Have you?
No. Perhaps Uncle Drosselmeyer shares Papa's dislike of hired help.
Just our luck.
She disappears through the shared bathroom, and I can hear her humming and throwing things about as she unpacks. My methods are far more effective, a simple matter of transferring my neatly folded clothes into drawers or the wardrobe, placing my painting kits on top of a bureau, and laying out my cosmetics on the dressing table. I'm rather fond of makeup. It's paint, after all, and I do love enhancing the natural beauty of a thing. I pause to check my face in the dressing table mirror. It's a decent mirror, though the edges are darkened and spotted with age. At least it doesn't distort my features. My travelling dress is fine enough for dinner, so I don't bother to change. Instead, I walk to the far end of my room, where the wall bellies outward into a bay window. There's a half-circle seat, thickly padded with cushions, with built-in drawers underneath. The window frames are ornately carved, arched and peaked like the windows in a chapel. The feathery curls of frost on the panes glow faintly orange with the last light of the setting sun. I press a palm to the cold glass, then think better of it and rub away my fingerprints with my sleeve. Next, I walk around the room, testing the gas lamps. They're all in fine working order, except one, which tends to gutter and fade before flaring up again. I turn that one all the way down. Louisa is still humming and thumping around in her room. Much as I love my sister, she tends to take over any excursion and dominate any room she's in. This could be my only chance to do a little exploring on my own. Quietly, I open my bedroom door and slip out into the hallway. The beauty of the house charms me, from the coffered walls and gleaming wood floors to the ornamental ceilings and hand-carved moulding. It's a lavish work of art, far different from the prosaic, plain house we had back in Lindgaard. But then, Lindgaard was a city of hard-working, prosaic people intent on amassing wealth for no other reason than to possess it. To me, wealth should be transitory. Money is simply a way to get more beauty. I peek into several rooms on the second floor, a small library with an adjoining map room, a couple more guest rooms and bathrooms, and a large linen closet, and then I descend to the first floor. Off the main entry hall there's a parlour, then a billiard room. A huge painting at the back of the billiard room catches my eye. It's a landscape, but like none I've ever seen, filled with oddly shaped trees, iridescent grass, and twisted figures half hidden among leaves. The gilded frame tempts me, so I run my fingertips along it, delighting in the delicate curlicues, until my fingers encounter an odd bump, also gilded, but out of sync with the rest of the design. Puzzled, I feel around it, then press on it. The bump gives just a little, and when I press harder, the painting pops loose and swings slightly outward. My heartbeat speeds up as I swing the painting farther away from the wall. Behind it is a secret door. I should go tell Louisa what I've found. She'll be peeved if I go any farther without her. But she always gets to discover things and do things. I'm more cautious by nature, so usually by the time I've analysed a thing and decided in its favour, Louisa has already plunged right in. That difference between us always confused my father. Perhaps he thought that I, as the creative type, had no right to also be well organised and prudent. But artists come in all varieties. Some are impetuous, loud and colourful, and some like to sit quietly, analyse a beautiful thing and soak it right into their souls. Some like to keep all their paints and brushes perfectly organised. Some like to occasionally make discoveries without the presence of their beloved but over-enthusiastic sister. I turn the knob of the secret door, and it yields easily. If Godfather Drosselmeyer didn't want anyone in here, surely he would have locked the door. Cautiously, I enter the dark space beyond. By the light leaking in from the billiard room, I locate a button on the wall. When I press it, several gas lamps ignite at once. I step inside, pulling the painting and the secret door shut behind me. I'm in a long, narrow room, a brilliant gallery filled with statuary, paintings and artefacts. A closer look at the artefacts beneath the bell jars and glass cases reveals items I can't quite identify. A cap dyed several shades of brown, a jewelled claw, a set of pearly white fangs on a gold chain, and a dagger that seems to glow faintly silver where it disappears into its sheath. Pinned to the wall there's a pair of dragonfly wings, much too large to have come from any dragonfly I've ever seen. Above them is a pair of antlers, sparkling white. In a glass cabinet in one corner there's a tall golden staff with an amber orb at the top, and in that orb is an eyeball. I could swear when I glance away, then look back at it, the eyeball is pointing in a different direction. The statues are strange too. They seem to be carved of soapstone in various shades, from pale reddish-brown to light jade to creamy white to soft grey. They resemble humans, but their bodies are longer, the proportions slightly different. Some of the figures' ears are like a fawn's or a calf's, while others are sleek and pointed. Their faces, too, are unexpected. Some run the normal human gamut of broad, narrow, rounded, symmetrical or lopsided. Others have distinctly bestial qualities, wolfish muzzles, bovine snouts, shrewd fox faces, insectoid jaws with mouthparts. Did Godfather Drosselmeyer make these? I never heard Papa mention him being a sculptor. A thump overhead startles me. Skittishly, I race back to the hidden door, slip out, and push the painting back into its spot. When I turn around, a wooden face is smiling at me with hideous cheer. I stifle a scream with my palm. The figure before me is life-sized, a wooden puppet dressed in a maid's black uniform with a stiff wooden skirt and jointed wooden legs. Her wooden features have been carved and polished with such care they seem lifelike. As I stare, thin wooden eyelids close over her eyes, then open again. Her painted mouth curves in a perpetual toothy smile, and she has glossy brown carved hair with a round bun at the back of her neck. She's holding a feather duster. With jerky steps, she minces past me and brushes the duster along the edges of the ornate painting. Then, with a crooked head tilt and that painted smile, she moves awkwardly sideways and begins dusting a bookshelf. Gracious, I breathe, backing away.
You've never seen an automaton?
The voice from the doorway of the billiard room startles me. I jump hard, and Godfather Drosselmeyer chuckles. Forgive me. I press a hand to my chest. No, I've never seen such a thing. How does it function?
Clockwork, he says. You've seen the figures in music boxes or cuckoo clocks, how they move and repeat certain patterns?
Yes, but...
I've simply increased this one's size and optimized its performance for certain tasks. Nothing to it once you understand the science.
I'm no scientist, but I've had a decent education. At home, of course, since Papa didn't trust schools. Still, I have a foundational understanding of physics and mechanics. Nothing I've learned supports the possibility of such an automaton. But Drosselmeyer is an innovator. He deals with advanced technologies. Maybe he has unlocked some secret to self-motivated clockwork puppets. Strange that I don't see any clockwork on the maid, just wooden joints.
It's nearly time for dinner, says Drosselmeyer. Go fetch your sister, if you would be so kind.
It's an obvious dismissal. He doesn't want me in this room any longer, nor is he prepared to entertain more questions about the automaton. Is it because he doesn't like explaining high-minded science to regular people? Or is there some other reason? I hurry upstairs, dart into Louisa's room, and close the door. I have something to tell you. 2. Louisa. Clara's story delights me. Secret rooms, puppet maids. Nothing this interesting ever happened at home. I want to go see the secret room at once, but Clara makes me finish unpacking first, and by the time I'm done, we have to go down for dinner. Lucky for me, dinner is served to us by a pair of wooden automatons, both women, both wearing black uniforms. Their movements are jerky, and there's a faint creak of wood sometimes, but they're practically soundless. Why use these and not real people? I ask.
Cheaper, says Drosselmeyer, and less annoying.
But surely real people could accomplish a wider range of tasks, Clara puts in.
You'd be surprised. How's your roast beef?
Delicious, I reply. And on that note, what's the situation as far as beef in this area? And when I say beef, I mean beefy men.
Louisa, gasps my sister.
They don't have to be men of means, I continue airily. When I marry, I'll have the means.
Indeed. Drosselmeyer cuts a piece of meat. Perhaps you forget, however, that as your guardian, I must approve any match you desire to make.
Clara kicks me under the table, a clear sign that I must not get angry. I must not rebel too openly or protest too loudly. Loud, careless Louisa, always someone to be quieted and apologized for. I am so damn sick of hearing her say, Louisa, to me in that reproachful tone. I am so damn sick of being treated like a rebel who must be curbed, simply because I want to make my own choices and enjoy my life the way I see fit. But for now, as much as I hate to admit it, Clara is right. I need to appear docile and obedient, at least until I figure out the character of our new guardian. Of course, Uncle Drosselmeyer, I say sweetly with a huge smile. I shall be delighted to rely on your judgment. As we finish dinner, I watch Drosselmeyer closely. Despite the slipshod appearance of his clothing, he takes care of himself. He's lean beneath the clothes and strong, judging from the way he handled our luggage upstairs on the way to the rooms. His beard is perfectly trimmed. Clara said he isn't someone I can seduce. I beg to differ. I can seduce anyone. The postman, our neighbour's gardener, the tutor Papa reluctantly hired to help Clara with math, the baker's son, the assistant at the bookshop, and many more. Can I help it if men find me irresistible? Women, too. There was the neighbour girl I kissed when I was 13, the baker's buxom daughter, and a girl in the village choir whom I fingered to climax under her robe during a festival performance. I prefer men, though. There's something so primal in the way they want me, the way their bodies react so boldly, prominently. I love a low, helpless male moan so much. I wonder if I could tease one out of Drosselmeyer. But I need to be strategic about this. Seducing him probably isn't the way to get him to approve my choice of a husband whenever I make that choice. This may call for a different kind of manipulation, and it starts with me finding out what he's hiding on the third floor. After dinner, Drosselmeyer takes us down a long hallway toward the back of the house. He shows us the ballroom, the second dining room, the music room, and the corridor leading to the conservatory. There's another hallway that apparently leads to the kitchens and the old servants' quarters, but we continue onward, stopping before a pair of huge double doors inlaid with chips of porcelain or glass or something, a mosaic of sorts. Clara seems very impressed by it. Drosselmeyer throws a lever beside the doors, and I hear the faint hiss of gas through piping.
Welcome, says Drosselmeyer, to my showroom,
and he flings open the doors. Beyond, uplit by golden gaslight, lies an immense domed space, huge enough to swallow us up, so enormous I feel like an ant beneath a giant's bell jar. Iron beams crisscross overhead, supporting the large curved panes of glass, a frosty layer between us and the black night. To some faraway traveller, the glass dome must glow like an amber beacon amid the stretches of bleak countryside. In the centre of the sprawling tiled floor is a giant round platform with circular tiers of shelves. On the shelves repose various mechanical contraptions, mostly of the clockwork variety. Other knick-knacks, bits and bobs are tucked away on the rows of shelving that line the left-hand wall, and I catch a glimpse of more items secreted in glass cabinets to my right. Amid the bronze gleam and the brassy glitter, Clara seems utterly overcome. My God, she breathes, then covers her mouth. I'm sorry for using strong language, but it's so incredibly beautiful. Beneath his neatly pointed beard, Drosselmeyer's mouth parts in a smile. He steps over to a crank on the wall and begins to work it, and as he does, the circular platform starts to revolve slowly. Once it picks up speed, he lets it go, and it continues turning without further interference.
These are primarily items for household and business use, he says. But there's something back here I think you'll appreciate a good deal more.
He leads us around the revolving platform into the rear half of the room, and this time I gasp in tandem with Clara. The entire back section of the space is occupied by an enormous doll's house built right out of the wall, with its first floor about knee-high.
Tiny gas lamps gleam in its windows, illuminating parlours, hallways, bedrooms, a kitchen, a dining space, even an attic.
Watch.
Drosselmeyer opens a panel nearby and pushes a few buttons. With a soft whir, figures begin to move through the interior spaces of the dollhouse, gliding along prescribed paths. The whole thing is as strange as it is fantastic. First of all, there's the unusual size of the dolls. They're each about the length of my forearm, from elbow to middle finger, which makes the house itself simply enormous as a plaything. But it's not a plaything, of course, because it belongs to a grown man, an inventor who, for some reason, has spent his time outfitting the entire thing with miniature furniture. I suppose when you build practical things to sell, you must sometimes indulge in a passion project on the side. But it seems an odd choice for a man like him, carving these wooden dolls or puppets and setting them into a furnished house. "Can they come out of the doors or look out the windows?" I ask.
"No, they do precisely what they are made to do and no more," replies Drosselmeyer.
I walk along the front of the house, peering inside. The dolls inside look a little off to me, strangely proportioned somehow. They have fierce eyes and grimly painted smiles. Some have sharp teeth and pointed ears. Others have tiny wooden claws.
"May I touch one?" Clara asks. No wonder she wants to look more closely. Every doll's outfit is painted onto their body in exquisite detail. Some even have tiny cloaks of real satin.
"This is my newest addition."
Drosselmeyer reaches toward the front door of the dollhouse, where stands a male doll with handsome carven features and a scarlet uniform, like a soldier's.
"This one is a bit of an experiment. He isn't just a doll, see?"
He tweaks something on the doll's back, and its mouth opens wide.
"You can place a nut just here and crack the shell between his jaws."
"Oh, I want to try," I exclaimed. "Where are the nuts?"
Clara frowns, but Drosselmeyer chuckles.
"In the kitchen. There's a row of canisters all labelled."
Back in a blink.
I dash off to the kitchen, leaving Clara to inspect the artistry of the painted clothing. When I enter the kitchen, I'm startled by the presence of three automatons. Their wooden heads swivel on wooden necks, scarlet mouths grinning at me, painted eyes glossy in the dim light. One is stacking dishes, the other two are simply standing close together as if I interrupted a chat. Which is ridiculous, because puppet creatures can't speak. Eyeing them sidelong, I step over to the counter where a series of ceramic canisters stand in a row. I select a handful of whole walnuts and then hurry back to the showroom.
"Ah, you found them." Drosselmeyer meets my eyes. "You look a bit pale, Louisa. Are you well?"
"Some of your puppet servants were there, that's all." I toss him a nut and he catches it easily. "Creepy, aren't they?"
"I suppose they are, if one isn't used to them."
He sets a nut between the nutcracker's jaws and works the lever at the rear. The walnut shell cracks and gives way. Clara catches it and extracts the nut meat, popping it into her mouth.
"Delicious." "My turn."
I shoulder in beside her. Drosselmeyer laughs.
"All my inventions, and the two of you are fascinated with a simple nutcracker."
"Papa didn't let us have nuts," I tell him. "Thought they were bad for our teeth."
"Nonsense."
Drosselmeyer sighs.
"Your father was a good friend, but some of his ideas..."
"Tell us about it."
I crank the lever attached to the nutcracker's lower jaw, and he cracks through another shell with ease. As I release the lever, I dart my hand in to catch the crushed shell, but in my haste I drop the nutcracker. He tumbles to the floor, knocking against the base on which the dollhouse sits. Something in the way the doll lies there, his legs crooked and his jointed arms flung outward, it looks so human and helpless.
"I'm sorry."
I bite back a curse, retrieving the nutcracker, locking his legs straight again and setting him back on the doorstep.
"No harm done," Drosselmeyer assures me.
He and Clara are already turning away, moving on to examine one of his machines, which he claims can wash dishes all on its own. But when I cast one final glance at the nutcracker, I notice that a sliver of wood has split off one of his arms. Swearing inwardly, I crouch down and search the shadowed tile around the base of the dollhouse. There it is, a splinter about half the length of my littlest finger. Of course I would break something on our first night here. I'm all...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?